And if you look at investment by companies outside the umbrella of the government's collaborative program, they were relatively rare in terms of investments. Now, one of the questions which keeps coming up is this lack of collaboration because of intellectual property issues? But when we quizzed people on that, we found that that was actually not the case. Intellectual property issues had very little to do with this. The real issue was that the cost and complexity involved in commercializing university research, that is science and engineering research oriented, is very high. And typically most research institutes cannot give you immediate solutions. They'll give you things which need a fairly long time for further development. And most companies were looking for solutions for tomorrow. They were not willing to put in the investments or wait long enough to convert the ideas from academia into something useful. So of course, in this particular study, we had also studied a government collaborative program, and this of course was successful in ensuring collaboration, but it wasn't very successful in having any technological outputs. Okay, so let me just shift gear a little bit and now look at the problem from the other side. So far I've been talking to you mainly from the perspective of industry, but let me also talk to you a little bit from the perspective of a research lab. So one organization I've studied extensively over the years, for more than 25 years now, is the National Chemical Laboratory. Partly for historical reasons, chemistry seems to have been the most or the strongest arena for collaboration between industry and academia in India. One reason, of course, is the drug or pharma industry, which I already told you about, and the process chemistry related work which a lot of companies did with UDCT and NCL and so on starting in the 1970s. But what is also interesting about the chemical labs in particular is, having developed that base, they have also now become more sophisticated players in the global R&D scenario. So let me just give you one example. So this is National Chemical Lab. So somewhere in the early 1990s, when Dr. Mashelkar was the director, he had this dream that NCL should no longer just be working with Indian companies. They should start working with global corporations, and they would be able to do much more exciting work, better research collaborations and so on. And what is interesting is, to make that dream happen, he invested in several new initiatives. For example, he completely revamped the infrastructure of the lab. He made the lab take on a much more serious approach to planning and marketing of whatever research they were doing. They started a whole program to support truly innovative ideas called Support for Kite Flying Ideas. The logic of this was that a lot of the work they were doing earlier was more, you could say, sort of imitative work than original work. So the idea of this was to incentivize people to move towards more genuinely new ideas. This was a very interesting thing they did. They created something called an NCL Research Foundation as a non-profit entity to provide various kinds of incentives to people within the lab to move them more towards industrial research. For example, the NCL Research Foundation gave gold medals to scientists who got US patents. Now you might say this all sounds a bit extreme, but the idea was very simple. The idea was that, like most research institutes, scientists in NCL were focused largely on publishing, particularly in the top journals. Many of them were reluctant to wait for publication to go through the patent process. So the lab was trying to create a little bit of incentive for them to look at patenting seriously. But another interesting thing here, which I was telling Sandeep, which I don't think he liked too much, is that Mashelkar also made a lot of personal efforts to open doors, in the sense that he reached out to a lot of the global companies, used his own networks to try and reach out to them so that they would give contracts to NCL. And of course, they made a very sustained effort to upgrade their capabilities as far as filing and retaining intellectual property is concerned. So these were a lot of foundational projects that Mashelkar undertook in order to shift the lab a little bit more towards the global R&D sector. What was the outcome of that? I'll just give you one example. This is something which happened several years later. This has happened in the towards the late 90s, but actually got commercialized in the 2000s. So this is a technology that was developed in Dr. Shivram's lab. Dr. Shivram is a polymer chemist, and essentially they developed some kind of micro encapsulation technology. I'm afraid I can't tell you the technical details, The basic technology led to 6 US patents. So they were actually came up with several new interesting ideas. But then they had this whole question, okay, what do we do with this? Where can we find an application for this micro encapsulation which we have created? So now you see the kind of effort which is involved. So Dr. Shivaram gave talks wherever he could get an opportunity in many of the top MNC research labs. In 2002, he gave a talk at Procter & Gamble, one of the top consumer product companies. So not even responded to by someone who attended his talk, the colleague of someone who attended came back to him much later, and they were able to come up with an idea where this could be applied. So the whole challenge of finding an application area is not a trivial challenge. Particularly if you've come up with something new, how do you find a connect with an industrial problem where it can be applied? So the idea was very simple. The idea was that this is a high-end fabric softener, and using this micro encapsulation technology, they figured out you can create a controlled release of smell. What's the advantage? When you store, say, wash towels in a cupboard, because this smell will be released, it will kind of retain a fragrance for a fairly long period of time, maybe up to a month or something like that. So anyway, P&G was interested in this. It decided to do an application experiment. Samples were sent out to P&G. At this stage, once it was proved that this can actually work, P&G licensed the technology and paid for further research. But this is the crux. From the industry side, they had to put 5 years effort before this could be used for the Downy product. During this time, NCL had to answer literally hundreds of questions, go through numerous changes and all the rest. Then, of course, P&G did test markets, test results. And finally, of course, another company in the US helped them scale up the whole thing. So you can just see that just this one process of commercializing this in P&G itself took something like 5 years, with a lot of, you know, back and forth between the company and NCL. So the point I'm trying to make here is there seem to be some pretty challenging steps. One is finding the application. Second, even if you find the application, then of course having a company which is willing to go the distance in making all these changes and going through all the iterative cycles to finally commercialize it. And then of course, hopefully it finally gets commercialized and you get some revenues out of the whole thing. Of course, one important part was the fact that NCL had taken all the patents. So this was a case where NCL had done the research, NCL had obtained the patents, and finally they were able to get patent revenues out of licensing those patents. So broadly you can say that having greater impact is a function of certain choices you make. A lab like NCL made that choice that we want to be more industry oriented. They put emphasis on that. They changed a lot of things within the lab and they went in that direction. Of course, there are people who have argued that it's also to do with how scientists think. How do you approach your research? So there's this very interesting book written by Ben Stokes in 1997, which is what he calls Pasteur's Quadrant, which essentially says it's driven by what are the priorities of the scientist. Is the scientist's quest only for fundamental understanding, or does the scientist also have an interest in what is likely to be the use and applications of the work he or she is doing? So you have clearly very different kinds of people. You had somebody like Bohr, who was much more oriented towards basic research, not very interested in the applications. You had somebody like Edison. You remember that he said, right, all this is 1% of the, whatever it was, the inspiration, and 99% of perspiration. So all those repeated experiments, and people who have studied Edison's work later said he could have been much more effective if only he had put a little more science and engineering into what he was doing, rather than just doing repeated experiments. And then you have somebody like Pasteur, who is the main example in this book on Pasteur's Quadrant, who actually combined strong interest in basic research with also a lot of the important applications which his work had to do, which of course led to pasteurization and a lot of other processes which were very useful in industry. So just for your consideration, I think it's also going to be driven by all of you as individuals, which one of these boxes you fall in. But I think the important thing is there is a box like this. There is a box which historically there have been examples of people who have not forsaken the fundamental research they are doing, but at the same time have also been driven by application and seem to have been able to do both. So that seems that that combination is possible, and that's certainly one thing perhaps some of you could think about. Okay, I just thought I'll sort of now just try to conclude, and after that I'm happy to take some questions. So I think one thing is true, and that's something we recognize, and I suspect this is going to get worse rather than better. In an era of the kind of financial challenges that most countries face, demonstration of benefits is going to be important. The economic justification of public goods may not be sufficient for governments to feel committed to support basic research on an ongoing basis. Therefore, whether you like it or not, most institutions have to find some way of earning legitimacy in society, and therefore creating some tangibility in the benefits they are creating is certainly useful. It doesn't mean everybody has to be doing that, but it certainly seems to be true that some clear demonstration in a tangible form is important for institutions to enjoy the support that they have been getting from the government in the past. Of course, there's the additional benefit, of course, that if you, particularly if you work with industry, there is additional income which can be used to further the objectives of the organization. At the same time, I would definitely say, and I think I've made this point several times in my presentation, that connecting research to Indian industrial applications is not a trivial task. It is a very challenging task. Even many startups who come up with good ideas, the final arena where the idea is applied is often very different from where it started. So they have to try different applications before the technological idea finds a successful application. People like venture capitalists often play an important role in connecting an idea with the right application, but certainly startups which are based on new technology struggle to this. However, at the same time, it's interesting that there's some good news as well. Now, many of the large multinationals today have people whose job is just scouting. Their job is to look at startups. Their job is to look at academic research. Their job is to understand where are people doing things which might be useful to us. In innovation literature, we call this approach open innovation, saying that companies are no longer restricted to just looking internally for what innovation they can do or what R&D they can do. They are willing to partner with a lot of other organizations because they realize that they can't have all the expertise required within the boundaries of their organization. So connecting with many of these scouts and people who are out there is useful. One important corollary of this is that you probably need specialized talent within the institute as well to help in this process. When NCL was trying to become more globally oriented in R&D, when they set up that business planning and marketing office, they essentially brought in people with industry experience. They brought in people with consulting experience. They brought in people who had been involved in commercialization. So they brought in people who had specific expertise in those areas, which will perhaps be required if you want to make this work. The last point, which I did not talk about earlier, but which I think is also important, is in history, when you look back, many times the gestation period from an idea to a successful application was quite long. Could be 30, 40 years. People used to talk about a 30-year cycle. But what we are seeing increasingly now is that many of these things, the cycles are actually collapsing. So for example, if you take things like video compression and so on, from the time people first came up with some of the ideas to the time it actually happened and became commercial is less than 10 years. So those times are crunching, which could be good news because it could mean that even some of the research you are doing might find its way into applications much sooner. So this is broadly what I wanted to share with you, that yes, there is a opportunity out there. It is probably largely with multinationals. They are the ones who have the resources invested to work with institutions and academic and universities and so on. If you can find the right match with them, then there is really a potential to share ideas with them, and it doesn't necessarily need to be finished technologies. In fact, what you often find is that large multinationals, they have enough resources internally to do a lot of the further work. What they are really looking for is good ideas, and if they can find good ideas, they are willing to translate them into products or services and take them to the market. So that's what NCL was successful in hooking into, and I don't see any particular reason why the IFR should not be able to do that as long as you're also willing to make some effort in that direction. So thank you. I think the research park in IIT Madras achieved a few interesting things. The first is essentially it tried to bring about some co-location. So it tried to at least bridge the physical distance between IIT and some of the companies they are working with. So many companies found it an advantage to set up not necessarily a big facility but a small facility in the research park. The second thing that happened as a result of the research park is that students could work on more application-oriented projects. So that helped a connect between the students and these companies. IIT Madras did one sensible thing. They made sure that companies could not use this simply as a place for renting space. They actually have an index where they measure each company's level of interaction with IIT. It's how many student projects did you give, how many collaborations did you do with faculty and all the rest. So when your lease expires, your renewal is dependent on the computation of that index. So they've actually created an inbuilt mechanism to make sure that the companies interact with the IIT campus itself. And in a few cases, there have been startups from the institute itself, particularly started or inspired by some of the faculty, which are also in the research park. So it's a combination. There are companies, there are startups, and in companies, I think there are both Indian as well as multinationals who are in the research park. So now I think other institutes are trying to replicate that. Yes, please. I don't know any recent studies, but there's an old study by Cooper which says that it's 1,000 starting ideas to 300 ideas deemed to be potential, have potential, which finally results in one successful product. That is the that is mainly from industrial R&D. From this is data from industrial R&D. Oh yeah, lot of failure, absolutely. It's definitely, and that will happen as you interact with industry for sure. So there are a lot of, I don't remember all the studies now, I read them long ago, but there are a lot of studies which have tried to understand what is the connection between academic research and innovation in industry. Later if you just remind me, I can send you some of those papers. So people have tried to understand what is the kind of conversion from academic research to innovation. And I think it does happen. I mean, for example, in the US, for example, people do use quite a bit of academic research, which has been done. For example, in most government-funded projects in the US, you have to put things in the public domain. So people have used that information to build companies and industries. So I think there is a fair amount of that which has been done. But I don't remember the, there's some, there were some findings of those studies which I can probably send you. Not so much in India, I think it's relatively low, but in the US, for example, it's much higher. That's true up to a point, right? Because as long as the Cold War and the fear of the Soviets could be used as a pressure point for getting research funding, it worked. But post the Soviet era, that's not been, of course, true. The other important thing is, I think that was fairly flexibly defined, you know, in the sense that, see, in the American system, people are quite clever at tapping into that money, whatever may have been the overall, you know, so it might be Cold War driven, there might be some priority, and then you try and align your research in such a way that you can justify it and pretty much do what you wanted to do, but tap into that money. I mean, so a lot of clever proposal writing, you could say, I mean, which managed to tap into a lot of those resources. So in the US, that's an industry in itself, right? Trying to align your proposals to where the current priorities are so that you can go and tap into that funding. But at some point of time, and I think this is probably about the time the Berlin Wall fell, from the 90s onwards, a lot of the focus has been more on the NIH rather than some of that Cold War stuff. And of course, it also reflects the fact that a lot of research shifted to bio and to those newer emerging areas rather than the areas which were being emphasized earlier. But yes, there is a, that whatever they call the military-industrial complex in the US, certainly was one important component of that whole system. That's undoubtedly true. Yes. Yeah, must be something like that. Yeah. So, you know, so NCL has gone through various phases of developing their connect with industry. So the Venture Center was one effort to formalize that, and also to move more towards startups, incubation as a method of commercialization. Prior to that, it was all doing work with large corporations and trying to sell ideas. Then at one point, it was realized that another method of doing that is actually to promote enterprises. So the Venture Center, I think, has been largely designed around that concept. I don't know if there's a detailed analysis of the success of the Venture Center. At least from a outside view, it looks to have been reasonably successful. At least they seem to have got a lot of startups going there. How successful the startups have been, I really don't know. But in fact, I suggested to them they should call Premnath, who runs the Venture Center, to come and give one of these talks. He can probably give you a clear picture of what has been the success. So I think it's a good question. I think it's a complex problem in the sense that one definite issue in India, which happens in some other countries as well, but is not so much of a problem in the US, is lack of mobility. Generally in India, people are either in one system or they are in the other system. You rarely find people moving across. Dr. Shivaram, whom I talked about earlier, he was one of those exceptions. He was actually the head of IPCL's R&D. And then he moved to becoming a scientist in NCL.
So throughout he was pretty good at, you know, bridging both industry and academia. I think what is really required is a few people who are what, to use some management jargon, we call boundary spanners. People who can, you know, talk the language of academia when required and talk the language of industry when required. And that there are very few of those in India, I think. So if you're talking about critical mass, I think one critical mass we definitely need is people who can play that transnational kind of a role. And some people have been quite good at doing that. One of the people I historically found very interesting in that area was Dr. A.V. Ramarao, who used to be director of IICT in Hyderabad. So he was an organic chemist, basically on his own worked a lot with pharma companies and was very good at making those sort of connections. But partly because of the mobility issue and partly because of the way both academia and industry work in India, we don't have enough of those people who can. Yeah, so there, I think there are some opportunities though. For example, if TFR, if you're really looking at this seriously, you could bring in one or two people who can play that role. Bring in somebody from industry who can, you know, be the interface rather than, you know, just depending on Chidipto and others to do that job. So I think that would be one. That's how NCL largely addressed the problem. They already had people like Shivram who understood the industry thing. Then they had feet on the ground who also understood how industry works. And the good news is, of course, in pockets we have those people. I mean, you take a company like Mahindra, for example. The guy who heads their whole automotive business is Pavan Goenka. He worked for a long time in the US in automotive R&D there before he came to India. That's one of the reasons Mahindra has been relatively successful in bringing a lot of new products to the market, where they didn't have that expertise earlier. They're not great. They know they're not great at research and design, but they're very good at getting ideas from people, integrating it together, doing the engineering, productionizing it. So they've developed a capability in that, and Pavan was very instrumental in creating that. So we need to look for more people like that. And I think for all of you as scientists, what's very important is you have to respect those people. If you call that person to TIFR and then you treat him like dirt or whatever equivalent of that, then then it won't work. No, it happens in all our institutions. Even I know in my own institute, we have tried that. We have tried to bring in people who can do the industry interface role, and faculty don't always behave very well with them. So that's a problem. You have to be willing to respect them for the capability they bring to the table. It's important. Yes, sorry, please. Yeah, so this is a good question. These are all difficult questions. In India, I don't think most institutions fall in any pure form. For example, CSIR labs, in a way, are national labs, but many of them actually are pretty somewhat university-like when you go inside them. They don't really do too much different from what a good research program in a university would do. Yes, you're right, the US system is quite different. But the US system is also, you have even corporations running national labs. They're not necessarily run by the government. In fact, government doesn't run anything directly in the US. Either a university runs it or a corporation runs it. So the mandate of those kind of labs is very different. I think what might be useful to look at is a mission-oriented lab, which has a particular thing. Maybe ISRO, for example, you could think of it as a very mission-oriented organization, which doesn't do only research, of course it does other things, but it's all, you know, focused on achieving a certain mission, compared to a institute like TIFR, which doesn't have a mission like that. But I think the core point I would make is, you know, nobody is expecting even an institute like TIFR that 100% of people would be doing industrial work. That's not what institute was set up for, and you don't have to do it either. But I think from the point of view of several of the things I mentioned, like legitimacy, like having better connect with the outside world, some percentage, what that percentage is something all of you are best, you're most capable to decide what that percentage is. But even NCL, for all the, you know, I gave you the positive side of NCL, I don't think more than 20% of NCL does, maybe even less, 10% of NCL does really industry-oriented work. A lot of people are doing their, you know, whatever research that they are doing in their labs and not necessarily reaching out to industry. So that they coexist with each other. I think, but it's useful to have some connect. That's what I would imagine. But how much connect and all that is something you folks have to decide. Oh yeah, sure. No, I mean, there's no doubt about that. It is, I mean, to be a little cynical, it's partly a marketing game. So it's all about how you project the utility of what you are doing. Some organizations have very tangible utility. You know, ISRO, you know, gives you brownie points for various things. You can see that. Other organizations, maybe you have to find ways of demonstrating your utility. And it could even be just a 2 or 3 big profile projects. But some, I think, in India, given the overall political setup, I think some devotion of resources to that is important just to manage the stakeholders around. Otherwise, you're running too high risks. I think it's also, you see, from the other side, you know, there's also an issue of how they organize things. So long ago, I had a discussion with Kota Harinarayana, who was the visionary of our LCA program. And so when the LCA program was started, they realized that a lot of capabilities which were required didn't exist in the country. Or they might have existed, but they were in pockets. Some one IIT had some capability with carbon fiber, somebody else had with something else. So the whole issue was, how do you get all these guys' inputs into so that you can design the LCA. So what Kota was telling me, the first round what he did was, he just went and told each IIT, you develop the head-up display. Somebody else, you go and you help me build this part of the, design the wing and all that. After 6 months, he went back to all those institutions, mainly IITs, and found nothing had happened. And then he sort of tried to figure out, why has nothing happened? And he realized that he simply had not, you know, defined the whole thing properly for an educational institution to take it up. So in the second round, what he did was, he started trying to think, how would a professor look at it? So he started dividing things into, these are M.Tech projects, this is a PhD project, this is what should be the outcome from this. And he said, then he worked with the professors on how to, you know, divide up the work and then sort of integrate it so that it will be useful to the LCA program. And in short, what he found was, the professors really didn't have the project management or the sort of broader integration capabilities to be able to do this. But once it was broken down into a tractable problem, which somebody in the lab, you know, an M.Tech student or a PhD student or whatever it is, a postdoc could do, then the progress was much better. So You don't need capabilities to be able to, you know, take that industry problem. Because industry problems often will not, as you rightly said, will not be posed specifically as a, this is a, the technical problem we want to solve. It will be posed in much broader and more vague terms, and somebody has to translate that problem into actual R&D problems which can be solved. And you need somebody to do that. That's tough. That's a skill which I think again people have to build. See, in this whole game, there are many skills which have to be built. I think you put your finger on a good point. Unless people are willing to devote some time to building those skills, it won't happen. Wherever people have done, NCL, they spent a lot of time trying to develop these skills. Nearly 10 years they spent, at least the core group of people who were involved in all this, how to work with a company, how to write a contract, how to agree on patent rights, how to, you know, all this royalty business. The entire thing, you know, it took them about a year, 10 years of working with them to figure out all this stuff. And the safety standards of the MNC, all many, many things like that. Yes, ma'am. Sure. You tell me when to stop. Yeah, sure. So that's what I told you, right, in that automotive study which we did, that's this is exactly this problem. So many companies had a lot of here and now problems to solve, and there was no role for academia or research institutes in those problems. So the only arena in which academia could participate was either in things like testing, analysis and so on, where those guys have already done something and you're just trying to verify, validate what they have done. Or when the company was willing to invest in slightly longer term programs. But I tell you, the good news is basically this. Globally, there are several companies, particularly the more profitable ones in general, who do believe in funding some long term programs. But the only problem is these programs have some volatility. So from time to time, you'll have, I give you an example of General Motors. Unfortunately, General Motors went bankrupt or, you know, soon after those programs. So when that happened and the US government had to bail them out, then all these fancy research programs had to be stopped. So they don't have General Motors anymore. But if there's no General Motors, there's somebody else who has, you know, programs like that. So a lot of the, I think, research scouting has to be which are the companies. So for example, one of your colleagues was talking about some work she did for Pfizer. So Pfizer at that point of time apparently had an outreach where they wanted to connect with research being done in China and India. So from time to time, you have companies driving these kind of initiatives. And in the long run, I think some Indian companies will do it as well. So I gave you an example of Mahindra. There are some of the pharma companies. India, the good thing is many Indian pharma companies have actually become quite big now. They're all become $1 billion plus companies. So they, at least in theory, they have the resources. So if you can actually find a way of working with them, it can happen. I'll just finish this. I think I don't know if they are aware, but they're interested in being aware. So I'll put it this way. So there are people now. I think that's changing a bit. For example, I was just telling Sandeep and others. For example, I recently had a long discussion. Tata's, after all these years, now has a chief technology officer at the group level. They didn't have somebody like that. So his job is basically to see what is the kind of new technologies that the group companies need, get them to collaborate with each other, get them to reach out to academia and so on. So his job is basically this. So many companies who are more serious about this, they're actually creating such roles for people whose job is to really find out what's happening in academia.